The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Tonight, we're excited to host Doug Rushkoff, Professor of Media Theory and Digital Economics at City University of New York, Queens College. His best-selling books, acclaimed for their intersectional explorations of cyberculture, religion, currency, and politics, among other topics, include Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, Program or Be Programmed, Present Shock, and Media Virus. He's also the host of the Team Human podcast, writes a column for Medium, and created the PBS Frontline documentaries Generation Like, The Persuaders, and Merchants of Cool. In his new book, Rushkoff reveals the flawed mindset that has led out-of-touch tech titans to prepare for a societal catastrophe they could avert through more humane decisions. Tonight, he'll be in conversation with Kevin Werbach, Chair of the Department of Legal Studies and Business Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, and author of For the Win, How Game Thinking Can Revolutionize Your Business, and The Blockchain and the New Architecture of Trust. Please join me in welcoming Douglas Rushkoff and Kevin Werbach to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Great. So thank you all for coming. Douglas, thank you for coming. Welcome, Philly.
Thank you. Thank you for doing this.
So this was a fun read, this book. And yet also something deep, something important, something very topical. So why don't you, you start the book with this crazy story about what you thought was going to be a speaking gig for a room full of bankers. Turned out to be something else.
Yeah, I write books about media and technology, and I'm often mistaken for a futurist. When I'm really something more of a presentist, just trying to observe what's going on. And sometimes, tech investors will invite me to come do a talk, about the digital future, and, to try to tell them about whatever's coming, blockchain or augmented reality or something. And I got invited to this, super high-priced talk. I kind of tried to stop them, but this one was like a third of my CUNY professor salary to go do one talk in the middle of the desert at a resort with hot tubs. And they flew me business class with warm nuts. Warm nuts. Who thought of that, right? It was great. So I go out to this resort, and they're taking me like 3 hours in this limo to the middle of nowhere, and I'm thinking, what kind of wealthy people are going to go to a resort out in the middle of nowhere for 3 hours? And just as I'm going over the last bluff, there's this, I see this Learjet landing, right along next to me. They've got, private airstrip out there. So I go to this thing. I don't see anybody. They're taking me around in a little golf cart into my own, pavilion with a hot tub and special things and hot rocks and all sorts of wonderful. Next morning, they take me out in my golf cart to go finally do the talk. And I'm sitting in the green room, getting ready and waiting for them to come and, mic me up to take me out to do the talk. And they bring these five guys into the green room and they sit around this table. And this is the talk. There is no talk. It's these five dudes, three of whom I looked up later and definitely are billionaires. Two, I think, probably are, but they're that good that you can't really find them online. And they start peppering me with the questions, Bitcoin or Ethereum, right? Which is going to make more money? Virtual reality or augmented reality? And he's like, this is not the kind of question to ask me. I would have said Betamax, not VHS, but whatever. I'm throwing out, okay, Bitcoin kind of sucks. It burns a lot. Don't do that. And then finally, they got to Alaska or New Zealand, right? Where should I put my bunker for the coming event? And that was the word they used, the event. The event to them is the climate disaster, electromagnetic pulse, nuclear accident, or social unrest that will end civilization as we know it and force them to retreat to a fortified bunker. And we ended up spending most of the hour on the question. I needle these people. You know, and they were talking about how they were flying out Navy SEALs to protect their bunkers from us, right? When, you know, like the Twilight Zone episode with the people who have their own thing, you've got to, how do we keep the masses away? So they're talking about the Navy SEALs they've hired. And I said, well, assuming the event happens and the world ends, why are the Navy SEALs going to do what you say when your money is worthless? And like they stopped cold. I say, one of them writes down on his little pad, what to do when money is worthless. And we spent the rest of the time, and they're like, well, you know, we could have implants in everybody that allows them to be, and then I could always, you know, shock them like a kind of shock collar with the implant, or we could have a safe where all the food is in a safe, and only I know the combination to it. And they're like, so what do we do? What do we do? And finally I said, well, look, I think the way to ensure that your security staff doesn't kill you in the bunker is be really nice to them today. And they're like, well, what does that mean? And I say, well, like, take your head of security and maybe pay for his daughter's bat mitzvah today, because it'll be a lot harder for him to shoot you between the eyes when you're down in the bunker. And I was trying to instill them with the idea that maybe if you're nice to everybody, then the bad thing won't actually happen and you won't need to go to this bunker. But that's not it's not the mindset that they have, you know. So it was crazy, and it was a life changing experience for me to see that the wealthiest, most powerful men I had ever been in the same room with are pathetic, right? They feel utterly powerless to affect the future. That the best they can do is earn as much money as possible and hang on for the inevitable catastrophe.
So one thing that I took away from this book, I mean, this is the opening story, but there's a lot more of these great stories, is, God, you are a buzzkill at rich people's parties. And yet they keep inviting you.
Yeah, although, actually, after this book came out, two talks got canceled.
Okay.
Right? Oops. No, but, you know, partly the wealthy invite me because if they're really wealthy and clever, they want someone to come in and water test what they're doing. I mean, I remember being in the room with those guys and thinking, why invite basically a Marxist media theorist to water test bunker strategies? And it's because it wasn't really the bunkers that they were water testing, but the philosophy behind it. Here's this kind of respected media digital thinker guy, and they're digital billionaires. What would he say about this, as almost from a sociological perspective? And they also, I mean, you know the kind of people they hire for their like sexual entertainment. It's always them getting kind of beaten, right? It's always them being tortured. So I think they invite me intellectually, just like, okay, be mean to me, you know, punish me for how terrible I am and all the terrible money I'm taking. Tell me like it is, and I can kind of purge it, and then go back and be ruthless again.
Okay, so you said the philosophy behind what the billionaires were saying. So what made you think that this was more than just crazy, pathetic billionaires, that there was actually something that this was not just an article, which it originally was, but this was a book?
I mean, a few things, actually. First, I started to see the philosophy that they were engaged in that room with me, exemplified in the technologies they're building. So, for example, I just saw, you know, our friend Cory Doctorow wrote a piece about Epson printers, that they are a certain model of Epson printer is built to stop working after a certain number of pages. It will shut down. You can't do anything. It ceases. And their justification is that there's a tiny little sponge in the printer somewhere that will be all filled with you know, loose ink. And after that, some ink might go on your table. So you can't replace the sponge, right? The 2-cent sponge. No, they won't let you do that. Instead, you've got to throw out the printer, right? Throw it on a nice toxic waste heap in Brazil for children to pick at to try to find renewable parts, and then dig up more rare earth metals in Africa or Australia to build a new printer. Now, the guy at the printer company who's making that decision, what is he thinking? Right? What does he think? He's thinking, I can earn enough extra margin on selling more Epson printers to escape the impact of what I'm doing, that I can somehow build a car that goes fast enough to escape from its own exhaust. It's kind of what I started to call the insulation equation, and I see them all playing it. How much money do I need to earn in order to insulate myself from the reality I'm creating by earning money in this way? And that, and I started to see it everywhere, and then COVID happened, and I started to see it in myself and my neighbors. I started to see, well, I don't feel so guilty that I have this Amazon Prime account anymore, or my Fresh Direct, or this little DoorDash. You know, I'm scared of what it's like out there. And all these other people, they're all going to go get my stuff and do the things and bring it to my Amazon doorbell where I can video and make sure I'm going to leave it there for a few hours. Remember when we were bleaching the stuff? Leave it all there and then bring it in and clean it. And I felt like each of us were living in a little kind of billionaire bunker and using technologies that seemed almost predestined to be used in this way. And that was what I saw. I thought all the way back to the early days to, I remember I was with Timothy Leary, of all people, when he was reading Stuart Brand's book on Nicholas Negroponte's Media Lab, which was the early, wonderful MIT lab for developing digital technology. And Leary's reading the book, and he's if, in case you don't know, he's like a big 60s psychedelic legend counterculture figure. He's reading this book, and he's circling everything in felt tip and all these colors. I'm thinking, wow, he loves the new technology. It's all afternoon he's reading. Then he finally finishes the book, and he goes, blah, and he throws it across the room. I'm like, what happened? And he goes, first, less than 2% of the names in the index are women. That's how you know there's a problem. And this was in the 80s, you know. That was before people really cared about such things, or men cared about such things. And then he said, second, I'm reading this, and he says, and I realized what these guys want is to use technology to recreate the womb. That he was a psychologist. He said, their mothers obviously were unable to anticipate their every need at the moment that they needed it, and now they want to build technology that's going to be basically surround them in a bubble of safety and anticipate their every need and make it so they never have to see a real person, a real woman, real moisture, or anything again. And since then, I've looked at technology really an urge. It's not the only urge, but an urge among certainly billionaire technologists taken from school in freshman year of college to go make as much money as possible for some venture capitalist and realize, oh, this is partly the tech dream, is that kind of sterile bubble with nothing unpredictable or scary that's ever going to happen.
And this is what you call the mindset.
Right. This is the mindset, right? How can I use technology really to solve for people? Right? People are the problem. Technology is the solution. The mindset is that reversal that happened with tech. When the counterculture, when we were playing with tech in the late 80s, early 90s, we were thinking, how can technology unbridle the collective human imagination and lead to new, unpredictable creative outcomes? Once a certain kind of capitalist got a hold of technology, it was about how can we use technology on people to make them more predictable consumers. So instead of looking for exploits in the machine, we look for exploits in the people. And the mindset, I mean, it's got a long history, but the mindset is basically that today. It's this understanding of people as dangerous and flawed and technology as a way to get them to be more predictable and not interfere with us. And we, on the other hand, if we are the technologists or tech investors, we can kind of level up, like in a video game, to a level above those people. I mean, when I see Peter Thiel's book, it's called Zero to One. What does he mean? He means that you have to exist one order of magnitude above all. Everyone's in competition. He kind of distorts this guy René Girard's philosophies. Everyone's in competition with each other, and they're all going to fight and find scapegoats and all. So you can transcend that and level up. Or Mark Zuckerberg, when Facebook stops working as well as it's supposed to, what does he do? He goes literally meta. I'm going to be meta. What does it mean? It means crypto, VR, something, blah, 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 hand wave. But all it really means is I'm one level above Facebook, which kind of failed, and regular social media. I'm going to be like Web 2 was to Web 1. Web 3 is going to be to Web 2. This sort of exponential logic, or financiers have it with derivatives. You know, stocks, which are already an abstraction of the marketplace, they're not good enough because it takes so long for my stock to increase in value. So what do? I get a derivative of the stock. That means going meta on the stock. So instead of buying the stock and waiting 3 months, I can buy the stock the future on the stock and compress that 3 months of time. Or I can get a derivative of a derivative. And as you know, the derivatives of market became so much bigger in a digital age than the real stock market that in 2013, the derivatives exchange purchased the New York Stock Exchange. So the New York Stock Exchange, which is already an abstraction of the market, which is arguably an abstraction of human needs, was consumed by its own abstraction. And this is what digital people understand. This is what digital is all about. It's a symbol system above reality. It's a digital map that's above our real world. And where they want to go is there. Take me there, like Ray Kurzweil. I want to upload my brain to there because that's better. That's meta. That's derivative. That's abstracted, and it's more powerful, and it don't have to mess with all the real scary people down here on the planet.
Is the animating force behind this, though, just capitalism? And you mentioned being a Marxist media critic. Is it, you know, Shoshana Zuboff, of course, talks about surveillance capitalism, one sort of dimension. Is this just sort of digital allows the full realization of that capitalist dream, or is there something different?
I used to just blame capitalism because of my early days as a cyberpunk and at more of a kind of a countercultural technology enthusiast, and I watched Wired magazine come along in 1993 and kind of, you know, usurp Mondo 2000's role as the arbiter of digital culture. So it was no longer cool cyberpunk people, but now how are we going to make money off this thing? And they declared the long boom, and you know, they said markets will grow exponentially uninterrupted forever. Yay! And I was like, oh, come on, how are you going to do that? And how do you do it? The attention economy, surveillance capitalism, extraction, and all that. So I blamed it for a while, but then the more I learned, the more I think about like that Timothy Leary story and this understanding and this argument for how to use technology, you can look back further than that. And I look to, say, the origins of empirical science. You know, there was this guy, Francis Bacon, who's basically credited as being the founder of empirical science. And when he was arguing to the Royal Academy of Scientists about what empirical science will do, he said, or at least he's quoted as saying, empirical science will allow us to take nature by the forelock, hold her down, and submit her to our will. I mean, come on. That's an odd thing to say. So for him, empirical science will allow us to dominate nature in the same way we might want to dominate a woman, right? To hold her down. Because why? Because women are scary. Nature's weird. It's dark and whatever. So what we're going to be able to do is with empirical science, we can put a measurement. We can quantify everything. Once you can, it's like taking a butterfly. You kill it and put a pin in it. You know, that's what we're going to do to nature. And that dovetailed so well back with capitalism. Sorry, it did. It dovetailed so well with colonialism. You get a guy like Hobbes. Great philosopher. Oh, yeah, we love Hobbes. What did Hobbes say about Native Americans? He said, treat them like part of the landscape. They're not fully conscious. Yeah, they're kind of people, but the Native Americans are like trees or tigers or ants or something, and you don't have to worry about killing them. You can kind of bulldoze over them the same way you do over trees or anything else in order to make way for civilization. So I really do look at that dominator mentality coming from a certain kind of science, you know, and it ended up today, sadly, you know, there are really bad people. Like you look at the kinds of scientists that Jeffrey Epstein wanted to fund. And why was he funding? He was funding a very particular kind of staunch atheistic materialist scientists, people, you know, like Richard Dawkins. I got in a great argument with him in the book where he's saying there's nothing going on here. Prove to me there's anything going on here beyond the material reality, because I'm sort of more spiritual. I was saying there's something spiritual. It's weird. It's wonderful that people are strange. We can embrace ambiguity. How do you know there's nothing? And like I'm supposed to prove there's something ineffable with words. And what he argued was that even human consciousness is itself an illusion perpetrated by our DNA, that we are just like cassette recorders playing memes. The memes are, if anything, the memes are in charge, and we're just passively running them. You know, we are all just subject to our selfish genes. So if you really believe that human beings are nothing and that the genes are everything, that really helps justify someone like Jeffrey Epstein, who wants to keep, you know, dormitories of young women who are going to bear his seed. You know, he had these giant facilities where he wanted to raise his children, but he was going to hire, you know, 20, 30 young women at a time to stay in these rooms. He would impregnate all of them, and then they would all carry forth his genes. And that was this kind of a life extension fantasy that, again, it's very consonant with the original Francis Bacon understanding of what science is. So I don't just blame capitalism, but capitalism sure helps. Yeah.
No, and this is, you know, just editorialized. Yeah. This is part of what's so awesome about this book, for those of you who haven't bought the book yet, is just the different kinds of examples that you're able to pull together into this thesis. And, you know, you've got the history of public relations, AOL, Time Warner merger. It's remarkable that you're able to find a thread through all of them. Mm-hmm. So then let me ask you the opposite question then, which is there anything new here, right? I mean, you know, the idea that, you know, private islands are not open to anyone who just wants to show up is not something novel. So what's different about this billionaire fantasy today?
A few things. One, with, you know, the difference between, you know, Augustus Caesar and Mark Zuckerberg, who wants to emulate him, right, and wears the haircut and everything. And we should be thankful it's Augustus and not Caligula, right, if we're going to model ourselves after a Caesar. It's still a dictator. But the difference is the worst Augustus Caesar could do is kill a whole lot of people. The worst today's billionaires can do is make the planet actually uninhabitable for anybody. So they have more catastrophic ability behind them. The other thing that's a little different is today's billionaires actually have what I would call a positive fantasy. That they actually, that's why I called it escape fantasies of the tech billionaires, not escape plans, which someone wanted me to do, or escape strategies. These are fantasies because in some ways, this is what they want. They want, there's an idea, it comes out of science fiction called accelerationism. And the most plain example of accelerationism we see in our culture now is Steve Bannon, who's like, let's pedal to the metal, tear it down so we can build something new. These billionaires, these tech bro billionaires of a certain type, and I mean the Peter Thiel, Elon Musk type, believe that we can accelerate, end, and rebuild, but better. Right? They have different words for it, like game B is one of them, because we're in game A. So let's just get rid of game A and get to game B. You know, plan two, it's like to reboot, like civilization 2.0, control alt delete on this messy thing and reboot to something new. And if you're safe in your bunker or in your spaceship or, you know, let's talk about white flight, right? Or in your digital cocoon of some kind, you can let this one go and then come out of your shell and rebuild civilization in a much more orderly and structured way. I mean, best case, it's no better than it was in Genghis Khan's era. And that's a pretty sad statement too, right? It's like, okay, what's different? Nothing's different. Here we are, right? Which is really kind of awful. But I do think digital does make some difference, you know, that, and this idea that digital allows them to go meta in a way that hadn't happened before. We used to colonize existing territories and subject their people to whatever, enslavement and torture, and extract their resources. Now we're kind of pre-colonizing this next realm, whatever we're calling it, augmented reality, Web 3. We're going to kind of pre-colonize it and then migrate humanity into there. So it feels a little bit different, you know. But yeah, I would say the main difference is the extent of devastation that they could create is really global.
So then what's one to make about all these wonderful, inspiring TED Talks, which you talk about in the book, or you know, people fly to Davos to talk about stakeholder capitalism, and what are we going to do to solve climate change? You don't seem to be too hot on those.
Well, they can save the world, right? I mean, my main experience with those kind of people are, you know, a lot of the tech bros, they'll like go to Burning Man or down to the Amazon and do some ayahuasca. And like half hour into the ayahuasca trip, you know, Earth Mother speaks to them, I'm dying, I need your help, you can save me. And by the time they're on their G5 back to San Jose, they think they are the exclusive salvation of humanity. And they come up with their plan for the Great Reset or the Game B. And I've got an eco-ville. I've got a software stack. A lot of them have, they call it a stack. It's a bunch of different programs. I have a software stack for a completely sustainable eco-city, right? All I need to do is clear-cut a forest and plant my nanobots in the ground and grow this perfect solar-paneled, beautiful, artificial architecture, agricultural thing. It's all perfect. It's all done. And so, like 15 minutes into their conversion, they don't want to join the climate movement. They're in charge of the climate movement. Or you look at the Great Reset, all these wonderful capitalists who have these wonderful plans for our instant 5-year conversion from combustible engines to, you know, solar, nuclear, whatever, electric-powered cars. Do you realize how much energy would be expended in order to do even a 10-year transition from coal and oil to electric vehicles, how much rare earth metals we'd have to dig out of the ground to get all the lithium batteries to make all the things, and how easily someone like Elon Musk can undo, and he did. He undid all of the energy savings of all the Teslas that have been produced so far. He undid in one moment when he went and announced, I just bought $1 billion of Bitcoin. The amount of energy expended in that transaction was gone. So when I talked to the Davos guys about all their stakeholder capitalism, their idea is we can save the world with these new green technologies and make $1 billion doing it. If there's not that and make $1 billion doing it, then it's inconsistent with the sort of the capitalism that they need to continue growing. So it's that but. It's that but. And what they don't realize is you could do it and spend down your obesity of extra $1 billion and not be burdened with all of this money that you don't ever need. You know, they don't, but it never goes that way. It's always got to be, I'm fine to do it. Or if they're tech bros, it's fine as long as it's a moonshot. We will fund Singularity University. We will fund your thing. We'll give you $100 million. Everyone compete. Join this contest. The winner who has a solution that can scale globally will get $100 million. Right? So they don't even, it's such an industrial age mentality. They don't accept the possibility. What if it's 10,000 small solutions that save us rather than one earth-shattering, you know, launch of sulfuric particles into the sky? You know, you don't want a single solution, a one-size-fits-all global solution. That's called brittle in tech terms. You want many, many varied solutions. You give $1 million to 100 people rather than 100 million to one.
So let me ask you about something that I was interested in the book, which is gamification. Mm. And I'm asking because I've got to give you a mea culpa, which is I have an online course on Coursera. I've taught over 500,000 people how to use digital game techniques to motivate people and get people enthusiastic about what they're doing. And half of the course is don't use it to manipulate people.
Right.
You point out that basically this is used widely to manipulate people and exploit and abuse them. Do I have something to apologize before? Is it possible for someone to do this and be good? You talk about B.J. Fogg as a similar kind of tragic figure. Can one use these kinds of techniques and not have them be abused in that way?
Well, I'm in some ways even more of an extremist than that. So, but to start, my two main problems with gamification are you're manipulating people. You know, it's plain and simple. You're using a game to motivate people to do something else, right? It's what Alfie Cohen, a great work psychologist, would call an extrinsic motivator. So, like, when you say, okay, you did this great thing, we're going to give you more compensation. Even that word, compensation, is such a weird word to use for your reward because it means they're compensating you for the work, and that's demotivating. What you really want to do is be in a company where if you do a great job, what do you get? You get more responsibility in the company, right? It's nothing gamified. You don't win the race of the cars moving through the Amazon, you know, fake racetrack when you move your packages properly. It's not that. It's there. So what do you get if you do good at work? If you do well at work, you get to be part of the Skunk Works tech innovation lab in the middle of the company. If the better you do, the more authority you get over what you're doing. I mean, and it's true. It works better for jobs that people like. Like if you're working in a bike gear company, you know, cyclist gear people, gearheads. Oh my God, if they get to be, oh no, now you get to try to invent a better bike chain or a better brake or a better this. Oh my God, they're going to jump in and love it. But anyone could do that. I mean, I've spoken to a cement company, and cement nerds, they love cement. They love it. Concrete and cement, and they would talk about it, and mold and this. I'm like, oh my God, you guys just love this stuff. And they did. And at that company, they did that. When you are great at cement, you do that. So from the simplest perspective, the gamification in most cases is turning technology on the people. How do we use the technology to get people to do this or get them to do that? So if my daughter has a streak is a way of gamifying her Snapchat use to keep her more addicted to the platform. So we're taking games in order to get people to do things that are not directly related to the game, in order to get people to do things that are not. But then we get to, even me as a social justice advocate and beyond, whenever I'm with people, even great people and climate people and all that, who say, how do we get people to ... is where I'm like, wait. Once we think we're the ones who should be getting people to do this or getting people to do that, we are being like my tech bros. We are rising one level above the people and deciding, how do I get people to do this and I get people to do that? Once you're in that frame, you're kind of, I think you're on the wrong track. So in very particular cases where it's like, okay, this is completely voluntary and everybody wants to lose weight and it's going to be easier to lose weight if we gamify this thing, then cool. But let's look at the long-term effects of using gamification to lose weight. Do you lose weight as long as well? Do you put it back on sooner or not? I mean, I think the more intrinsic you can make the rewards, the more directly tied to the thing, the better off you are. But I don't blame you or even BJ Fogg. You know, BJ Fogg runs a lab at Stanford that's sadly called the Captology Lab, right? Which is it's a lab at Stanford that's designed to figure out how do you do behavior modification with digital technology. And so they do things like, you know, you port the algorithms from Las Vegas slot machines into social media feeds to figure out how do we addict people to social media. And everybody in that movie, Social Dilemma, ended up blaming him, saying, oh, BJ Fogg's the one who taught me how to do this horrible stuff, and now I see how terrible it is for everybody. And I called BJ Fogg and I go, dude, this is kind of bad what you've done, isn't it? And I've always blamed him in my books too. And he said, turns out he's like a gay Mormon who is so ethical and has always meant for his stuff to be used voluntarily by people to like help them balance their checkbooks, help them behave in ways they want to. And these guys didn't even take his classes. They like read one of his books, do the worst. He wanted them to take his classes because he spends the first half, like you do, on ethics. This is how we're using it. We've really got to look at, are you getting someone to do something that they want, or are you trying to train? I mean, all that stuff. And that's, again, it's my problem with plucking kids out of college when they're freshmen. You know, poor Mark and Bill and all of them, they have a great idea when they're freshmen. Oh, I got a good new piece of software that's going to connect people or get kids laid or do whatever this great thing is. And some venture capitalist sees them, plucks them out before they've taken history, ethics, economics, philosophy, anthropology, sociology, anything, pluck them out, and now the kid who's frontal lobe isn't even fully developed, right? They're 19, 20 years old. They don't have the myelin sheaths on their frontal lobes, haven't even established. They don't have impulse control. Poor little things. And now they're transferring parental authority onto who? Onto Peter Thiel? What do you think's going to happen, right? Where you're going to get what we have.
All right, one more question, and then we're going to go to the audience and invite you to ask your questions. One of the fascinating things you talk about towards the end of the book is what might seem like the opposition to this mindset, the people who just want to, you know, tear it all down, the QAnon people, the people that are radically opposed to this idea of let's have everything be ordered and precise and so forth. You say they actually mirror what they're fighting. How does that happen?
It's interesting. I feel like the QAnon people, let's just call it as a category, the sort of the conspiracy theorist people, in a sense, they are the only people around who actually take the tech bros at their word. If you believe what Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and Jeff Bezos and all these folks are saying about the future of technology, about what nanos and AI and all this is going to do, if you believe the World Economic Forum's, what they say about the Great Reset and how we're going to be able to tag everything in existence and put it on the blockchain in order to make sure and monitor, you'd be QAnon too. You'd be a conspiracy theorist too. So I feel like these are the guys who believe them the most. And interestingly and cynically, some of the tech bros, the one who want to bring on the end, the ones who are sort of on Bannon's side, they are cynically exploiting this contingent. When I look at the way an Elon Musk trolls on Twitter to activate this group of angry, young, sexually frustrated Gamergate boys, it's really cruel. But I understand what happened. Steve Bannon watched what happened with Gamergate. If you don't know what Gamergate was, it was basically an attack on some women by a whole bunch of gamers online who felt like women were kind of invading their space and promoting nonviolence in games. And it was like, oh no. And they got really, really angry and did really awful memes and harassment. Steve Bannon looked at that and said, ah, there's my army. There's my foot soldiers. All I have to do is get them to do this for the alt-right memes, or somehow combine alt-right memes with that kind of incel Gamergate energy, and I'm going to own social media. So there's and Peter Thiel is also, I mean, I don't know if he's going to be mad at me, but you know, Peter Thiel is throwing dinners up in his, you know, Montana ranch with Tucker Carlson and neo-fascist philosophers and Bannon and the whole gang, right? It's one group who has a common interest in kind of, I hate to say, in bringing on the end of this civilization. You know, they feel like this one is corrupt, which is why they're telling the kids that our civilization is based on a multi-thousand member ring of pederasts who run the government and the banks. And I mean, this is really old. I mean, you know where this comes from, right? I mean, this is old protocols stuff. And it just it's gotten retrieved in the digital age the way it was in the Russian pamphlets of, you know, 1910. And it's a very cynical, dark approach to population management, right? Which is, again, for them, we're gamifying something. It's a game. Who can come up with the best meme for, you know, go Brandon or whatever. Let's go Brandon. Who can come up with the best one of those? And you get the positive reinforcement. You get lots of clicks. You get lots of likes. And the more likes you get, the more you're going to do. And I think we've set something in motion that is kind of awful, which is why I really don't want to support these companies and these people. And I feel like it's important to just expose the mindset that's driving it, and not in a scary way, but ideally, and I hope this book does that, in a funny way. If we can laugh at these people, it makes them smaller. They're crazy. They're children. None of it makes sense. It's not right. They can't get off the planet. They can't upload their consciousness. They can't survive in their bunkers. The worms will get them. It doesn't work. So you see them in a meeting with me. These are them. And they never thought of this. And they didn't think of that. And they think their security guard's going to take care of them after the apocalypse. It's like, all right. It means we're on our own. It means it's us, right? We're in charge here, not them. And the sooner we can realize that and stop worrying about them so much, then we can get on with actually making this place a place we want to stay and live rather than something we have to escape from, which is their model.
All right, let's see what questions all of you have. Just raise your hand if you have a question, and then the mic will come around.
I have a smorgasbord of questions. Please pick the one that you want to answer. Number one, what would it look like if the women were in charge? So if the Cheryls and the Megs and the Marissas were in charge, would we still be in the same place? Number two, what do you really think of Mackenzie Scott? Number three, what is really wrong with Peter Thiel psychologically? And number four, will you please rank the tech bros, the Bezos, the Gates, the Brins, the Thiels, from evil to most evil?
Wow. Sadly, if the only way to answer the what if women were in charge would be to ask which women, right? You know, Sheryl Sandberg was in charge. She was in charge, you know? So, I don't know. In some ways, she was worse than Mark. You know, in some ways, I saw moments when Mark Zuckerberg is like, well, wait a minute. This isn't how I wanted things to work out. And I feel like she was the one saying, don't say that. Don't say that. Say everything's fine. It's all going. I feel like if I could have gotten him in a room, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, I might have been able to shake some sense into him. But he had the wrong people around him. So if women are indoctrinated by the mindset, then they're going to do the dominator, you know, do the dominator thing as well. But if whatever we now identify with the, and I hate to get new agey, but the female archetype, our understanding of sort of the human narrative were in place, right? If we stopped, I have a whole chapter on Aristotle in here, and there's this very male need for finishing. Let's put it like that, right? For finishing, for a climax, resolution, and sleep. And that's the male narrative arc since Aristotle. And the tech bros all see an end game as a requirement, like a Marvel movie. We need the end game. We need the big bang moment thing so then I can go to sleep. And I feel like there's other narrative forms that I identify with Ibsen's Dollhouse, which I just taught today, actually. Ibsen's Dollhouse is this beautiful thing. It's this well-made play in the 1890s, and he was a staunch feminist. And the play is supposed to end, like, happy, and the main character, Nora, says, no, wait a minute, this is not working for me. And she kind of takes off her costume, sits down at a table, and says, honey, we have to have a real talk. I'm a doll in this. This is not... So it's a different narrative style, and everyone threw rocks. They hated him. They banned the play. It's like, oh my God, this is awful. You broke theater. But that's what we have to do. We have to break that. We have to break that narrative. In terms of the spectrum of these men, it's hard to say. You know, there's sins of omission and sins of commission, and you know, evil is right. Good and evil is really tricky. I would put the spectrum as less good and evil, and more how consciously are they trying to bring on the end of times, and versus how much do they want to prevent the end of times. So Bill Gates believes that by creating a land-owning monopoly of agricultural land in America, that he can stave off the end of times. He believes that his understanding of systems theory and how systems work will enable him to orchestrate something superior, you know, to what we have. You know, it might be making things more brittle and hastening the end. You know, when you look at, you know, Bill Gates funded things like, you know, sending mosquito nets to Africa because he knows they have this malaria problem, and then the people there end up using the mosquito nets to catch fish, and the mosquito nets have this poison, so they end up poisoning their own rivers and killing the fish with the skin. It's like, oops, meant well. Right? He meant well. So that's not evil, but ugh, you know. It did worse than buying $1 billion of Bitcoin. you know, from the guy who does want to bring on the end. So I look at them, for me, I look at them, how close are they to Bannon? How close are they to this accelerationist thing? How much are they wishing, how much do they need the end to happen in order to bring on their plan of going to Mars or uploading or this, and versus how much do they want to, in a misguided way, save us through their hubris? You know, and save us through their hubris seems to me less, if you're going to use good evil, less evil than let's bring on, you know, bring it on.
Thank you for your talk. It's great. I guess I'm not really forming the question I really want to, but it's what I'd like to say is we always have problems with systems, you know, and tools are what we use to deal with systems, right? The more technology we have, is the tools we have amplify what we can do. Mm-hmm. So where we're at right now is obviously we have a huge amplifier where everybody has a megaphone, where everybody can influence large amounts of people. It seems that no matter what we do, what kind of system we have, the problem always comes back to us. You know, I see the problem and it is us. Mm. Whether it be a capitalist government, a communist government, a socialist government, if you look at what, you know, Russia does to weaponize information, well, that's pretty bad. If you look at what China does with social demerits, and if you don't cross against the light, you're going to get less, you're not going to be able to do things. That's really bad too. Capitalism, like democracy, is a lot of times the lesser of all evils. And I wanted to see what better way can you do things, what system is better than capitalism if you have the other competitors are communism, socialism, those kind of things, as we've seen them demonstrated.
I think the object of the game, if we want to use a little gamification language, the object of the game may be less important which top-down system of orchestration we adopt than how do we do everything else? How do we engage with our neighbors? Do we share with them? Do we, in other words, capitalism or not, we do not need every family on the block to have a minimum viable product Home Depot lawnmower. It would be way better to have one well-made metal lawnmower that the whole block shares, because most people are only spending a couple of hours mowing their lawn. Now, the problem with that, of course, is the lawnmower company is going to be upset. They go, oh, no, if fewer lawnmowers are being sold, then we're not going to have as many jobs for lawnmower makers. And, oh, my God, and the economy's not going to grow. And sure, that's a problem. But it's a problem for the balance sheet, not for us human beings. So the more we do for and with each other on a local level, the less it matters whether they're MAGA people or, you know, Bernie people. When I was digging out my neighbors from Hurricane Ida, did you get that one here too? Hurricane Ida was really bad for us. We were all just totally in the mud. I'm standing next to a volunteer fireman, total, like in a MAGA hat, you know, and next to another one here, and me in the middle, and that one there. And we had very different politics, but we shared our desire to dig Marsh's house out of the mud together. And it just became so clear I sound like Bill Clinton here, but we had so much more in common in the real world than we do on the world on the screen, than we do in the stories we tell about how this is. So the more those top-down stories and plans dictate how we function, the more brittle a society we are. The more we know our neighbors, the more resilient a society we are. So without being communist or capitalist, I would say, spend as much time as you can with your loved ones, with families, with friends. Take, and I don't mean to get religious, take a Sabbath. If all of America took 1/7 of their time off, first it would throw America into a recession, right? Because we're going to buy and sell. If you took one day and don't buy and sell things, it would change the balance of power in this country overnight. One day, because then you'd have to, like, and you're not going to get in a car, you're not going to go anywhere, you're going to have to walk around and meet your neighbors. Who does live over there? Let's hang out. Where do we hang out? Where's the park? Oh, the park got turned into a shopping mall. Oh, that sucks. We need a park so we can hang out, play cards, make love, have conversations, have multiple generations in the same space interacting with each other. So I'm trying to encourage not gamification, but people to play with each other again. You know, and it's so hard to justify it. It's so hard because we feel like it is our responsibility as citizens to keep the GDP growing. But since when are we in service of the economy? The economy is in service of us. And particularly in a digital economy that's supposed to grow exponentially, there's no way to keep up. There's no way. The only thing in nature that grows exponentially, really, is cancer, and it kills its host. Right? So exponential is not for real world. Exponential is for digital. But we can't conform to digital. We can't conform to the digital realm. We don't work like that. We are something else. We are biological. So that's, I mean, pick whatever system of government you want. You know, if I know my neighbors and we're going to stand up for each other and protect each other and work with each other, it matters a whole lot less.
Where do you see education going in the next 10 years?
Where do I see it, or where would I like to see it? My problem with education right now, and I talk to principals and presidents of universities, and they are still going to corporate CEOs and asking, what do you need people to be trained in? How do I create students that are ready for your jobs? Since when is public education the supposed to absorb the cost of worker training? That's not what it's for. Public education, you know why education was started? Education was started so that the coal miners in England could live with dignity, so that in addition to working, they could come home and read a paper and be an informed citizen and vote. It was so that you could enjoy a novel and advance your human capacity to conceive of the world that you're in. And now we've decided that schools are in service of the market to create good workers for these companies so they don't have to pay for training. Screw that, right? And the more you go down that line, the more you can justify, oh, well, let's get iPads in. You know, I teach every year, first day of class, I get a note. Now I get three or four from students from their psychotherapists that say, please excuse Johnny from class participation because he has a social anxiety or he can't make eye, he's got this. And I'm thinking, where were Johnny's teachers K through 12? They put Johnny on an iPad. The thing you do where I want to see education go is not where it's going, which is toward the iPad and automation and fewer hired teachers and online assessments, which will always assess the online learning better than anything else because they're assessing their own friggin' product with their own tests. I want to see kids learning how to be in a room with other people. I want people to remember that what education is not learning facts from the teacher. What happens in education is a process called mimesis. What you're doing is you as a child are observing an adult learning and thinking in front of you. You are seeing, what does learning look like? What does thinking look like? What is the body like? What is the mind like? When I throw a question at the teacher, which way do their eyes go? How do they assemble thoughts? When do they do lateral thinking and take an idea from here to put it together on their feet? You're in a living room. So the idea, certainly K through 8, certainly, is about that living, embodied exchange, which now we get in theater class maybe a little bit in gym, but the classroom is a living space. They spend enough time on screens at home and in the street. And when they're with their friends, they sit and text each other. Turn the classroom, that 6 hours you have them during the day, that precious 6 hours, make it the time that they can be embodied. You know, and that may happen if people like me, you know, were in charge, but I'm concerned it won't, except for the wealthy. You know, except for the wealthy tech bros I know who make the apps on the iPhones and don't let their kids use it. The tech bros I know, they send their kids to Waldorf schools and Rudolf Steiner schools where they're not even allowed to touch this stuff. They live up in Topanga or in the mountains of Petaluma. They have a goat share, an organic this, and, you know, a Faraday cage around their friggin' house. They know, you know, and the way to see how they know is how they treat their own kids and their own families.
I have 1,000 questions, but I'm going to start with this one. In my interactions with some of these folks over the last few years, it has struck me that although they reject religion, this mindset has everything in common with a religion, yeah. Right? It's about transcendence. You have high priests. There's this element of fantasy that somehow by magic we skip to AGI. And yet they will tell you they are rationalists,
yes.
Right? And this is the thing that's made me crazy, right? You're rationalist, but everything you do feels like a religion. And so, but I'm sorry, I haven't yet read your book, but I'm listening to you and I'm thinking maybe I'm not crazy because I was raised in a very religious household, so I see that everywhere. But and it may or may not be there. Do you see that parallel? And if so, does that somehow allow us a path into conversation with them to respond in the same way that we might to a religion or to a cult?
Yes, but we can't let on that we believe they have a religion. I've tried. So Wittgenstein dealt with this. Philosophies, like, we know this. You know, rational thinkers have put to bed the idea that scientism is not itself a religion. Because, you know, when they say that they live in evidence-based reality, well, when did you decide that we live in an evidence-based reality? You know, I live in a fucking David Lynch movie. You know, it's like, oh, sorry. You can bleep it. It says that it's not. This is not evidence, and nothing's working evidence-based. It always is. Everything breaks, and and because they are newly liberated from, or newly apparently liberated from the religions of their youth, they adopt the religious structure like babies. Like babies, you talk to them. The one they always talk about is emergence. That there's all things that are literally in one state, and then things get complex, and then through emergence, they're operating at another level of complexity. Emergence. You know, emergence is their magic alchemical, well, it's called emergence. You put a word on it, doesn't mean you have any idea what you're talking about, does it? Right? No, it's all turbulence and chaos and feedback loops and an emergence and a new state of order, and thus it's conscious. How do you know consciousness doesn't predate matter rather than be an emergent phenomenon of matter? You don't know. You don't know, right? They don't. But you can play with them with the fact that they are so religious, that a Peter Thiel, who was raised Catholic and now reads René Girard and believes that there is a transcendent moment closer to Russian Orthodoxy, if you want to play with religion, that we kind of transubstantiate to this other level. They were really good at it. They're the ones who really kind of created the New Age, you know. Russian Orthodox became this thing in Russia. The Russian New Age was called Cosmism, the Cosmists. They went to Esalen, and we had two-track diplomacy meetings at Esalen with our people, like John Lilly and our crazy counterculture people and our early computer people and the Russian Cosmists who were like, you know, sleeping with dolphins and eating psychedelics and believing in conscious robots in the future. That's really where they came together. But this transcendent idea came to Silicon Valley. And they all have this very strict, you scratch, you know, Richard Dawkins or any of these guys, and they have a purely Aristotelian arc with this Deus ex machina moment at the end where everything changes sort of magically. And you realize, oh, they're stuck in the same place. Even in my friend Terence McKenna, on our side, a great psychedelic countercultural guy, he's like, yes, but, you know, in the end, only people who have had the DMT experience will be able to rise from the chrysalis of matter into pure consciousness and make it through the bottleneck at the end of time. That's Catholicism, right? That's like right there. So the structures, it's so hard to not adopt them. But you've got to sort of pull back and see the structure of their logic rather than the content of it and work with them on that.
All right. We could go on a
forever.
Long time.
Hopefully we will. But you know, as a species anyway.
Certainly. Yeah. That was amazing. Douglas Rushkoff, thank you so much. The book is Survival of
thank
the Richest.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And for letting me gab on like that. Sure.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.